The sonata for harpsichord I wrote for this occasion. My daughter, Jean Nandi, has always wanted me to write for harpsichord, and I never felt that I wrote a really good solo piece. I think I still can do better, because I'll play the harpsichord a little bit, fool around with it, and then that will make me feel a little freer in writing for the instrument. But anyway, I wanted to write something for her for this occasion, and so this was it. I wrote it last summer. The only pieces I'd written before were, as I say, in connection with other instruments, I was able to do it more easily. But this is a solo piece, was really the first extended one which I've done. And
there was a recording, I think, made many years ago of a, was it a quartet on I guess, first edition records or something?
That's right. Sylvia Marlowe commissioned a work for a quartet of flute, oboe, and cello, and harpsichord. And the only trouble with that is that when it was recorded, she had a microphone under the harpsichord, so it sounded much louder than I had intended, and louder than a harpsichord could sound.
Right.
So I wanted to use the harpsichord in its real sound, delicate, and so on. And I know Virgil Thompson came into the room. He reviewed this work very poetically, and he liked it very much. And he came into the room where they were playing the records. He said, "Sounds like a bunch of trumpets." And I agreed with him. I never liked that record because of that.
Uh-huh.
If it could only have been left alone, every time I've heard it in the hall, it sounds the way I want it. But that's one thing that seems to have been the trouble with harpsichord music of mine, which has been recorded. Same with the suite or whatever it is for, or duet for violin and harpsichord.
Yes.
I just don't like that because it sounds tremendous, like a collision of cars or something. It's a terrible sound, and it really should only be very delicate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it will come out at least more or less the way I intended, as long as it's no microphone right under it, or too close, so you get a distortion.
Uh-huh.
A Celestial Canticle, this I wrote for my wife last summer. I wrote several things I've been writing for the last few years for her, and this was more or less the first performance publicly. There was a kind of a convention in Minneapolis where I've been performed recently, and she sang this, I think. I'm not sure that she did or not. We've done it somewhere, but I'm not sure now. But we may have done it for a church group or something like that, but a rather special group. But this is the first real concert performance of it.
Well, this afternoon, we've got as our guest Alan Hovhaness. This is Steve Wolf.
And Will Nofke.
And we're interviewing Alan Hovhaness after his 1750 Arch Street concert last night. Welcome to the program, Alan. Glad that you could make time in your busy schedule to grant this interview. Well, you've lived in Seattle for how long now?
Well, let's see. I first went there in 66 to conduct the youth orchestra with some of my music, and then I was made composer in residence with the symphony, with the Seattle Symphony in 67. So I always kept coming back to Seattle, and then in 72, I finally came back and decided to live there. I'd been living in New York before, and sometimes I'd had a place in Switzerland for quite a while, and I couldn't afford to keep that going somehow. Mm-hmm. So I felt that this was the nearest to the Swiss Alps somehow. The mountains around there are very beautiful around Seattle.
You've concentrated in the past basically on Near Eastern modes. Has your interest in the Oriental, in the Far Eastern, increased since your marriage?
Well, it's I think that has been with me for many years too. But I've certainly, I'm hoping we can do something together in the Orient this time. And I feel very close to it. It seems as though There's a kind of marriage in my music anyway with the Far East and the Near East. Oftentimes the same melody will have a combination of Japanese and Armenian modes. It just seems to happen naturally. So the marriage is a part of it, the actual marriage. But I think that this started really back in the early 40s, an interest in... I used to improvise in the Armenian church. I had a job there with this organist, and you have to improvise a good deal there. And I did a lot of improvising in Armenian modes between various parts of the mass. And I used to introduce the Japanese mode sometimes. I think it was forbidden by law then. But naturally, nobody knows anything about music anyway, as far as... And so I used to like to try it out on the Armenians. And they found it very interesting. And I would sometimes combine it then, because I was fascinated by what Japanese music I'd heard. Naturally, I didn't know anything about it. And then years later, I began to get very much interested when I saw some Japanese theater performances. So that I loved later studying gagaku in Japan and ak music in Korea. Mm-hmm. So the Far East has meant a great deal to me because there are living traditions that still continue. The Near East, it's a little harder to find living traditions. They've sort of been disappearing very rapidly in the last 20 years. Fortunately, I caught it before it disappeared in the early 40s and the late 30s.
Wasn't that about the time that you had you destroyed your previous compositions that you composed in the 30s? And I read that there were a number of symphonies and string quartets and things that were disposed of at the time.
Yes, I did. I had an enormous amount of music, and I lived in a very tiny room. And I felt this music was oppressing me because I wanted to make a new start. So that once I started really being involved in Near Eastern music, I felt this was a new beginning, and I destroyed everything I could. There are a few works that survived, like the Prelude and Quadruple Fugue, and parts of Mysterious Mountain also came from the earlier period. But I felt I could do everything better, and so I just threw away an enormous amount.
And have you ever regretting throwing away all of that?
A few things I regret. I could have put them under another name. which were things that were of a different style entirely, early things. But I regret more of the things I wrote when I was in my teens. Mm-hmm. Some of the early work when I was 20, I went through a kind of confused period, and so that was a kind of conflict.
What were your primary influences during that period? What was your music like then?
Well, I can't describe it too much. Mm-hmm. It's more or less like it is now in a way. It was, I came under various influences, and when I had a sort of scholarship and was studying, I felt I lost something, which I regained, especially when I began to really go into Armenian music. And I was able to develop through I call him my teacher, the Greek mystic and psychic who was a painter, and he inspired all of us, really, a group of us in Boston. He was a great teacher, I think. And somehow, philosophically, he gave me something, a new direction, which I felt was very necessary, and I felt I lacked that direction before. I was looking for it, but I really lacked it. So I was glad to destroy earlier work and to give my full attention to another way of thinking and feeling.
What was his name?
Well, it's a peculiar name. He was born with as Ermolaos Ioannidis, born on the Greek island of Mytilene. He had a pretty good voice, and they wanted to make him an opera singer at one time, but he didn't have enough money to be able to ever stop being a counterman working over a counter. But they said, you've got to change your name. In Boston, they had an Italian opera book, so they gave him an Italian name, Herman Di Giovanni. So his name is not very much like him, but that's the way it is. And he was a very childlike person, so he changed his name, and that was it.
Mm. Was he a musical philosopher, or did he write on philosophically in other modes?
Well, he was actually didn't know much about music, but he was a psychic, and so he got knowledge that he didn't know, and was very helpful this way. He even helped me to learn some of the old neumes, because I had some of the information, but not all of it. But then we would sit in the restaurant, and he'd say, "Oh yes, this means so and so," and he was a very, very powerful psychic, remarkable man. Music wasn't his subject. He had a good voice, and I actually tried to help him a few times in singing, but I think he was a little too old by then, and there wasn't any. He had to work too hard. He had to work so many hours, and then whenever he had free time, he'd give this to us to teach us without, this was just a matter of friendship. He never made any money at all.
That seems to be the plight of many who are involved with music.
Yes, that's true.
Would you prefer to have subsidy from government, for example?
Well, I don't know, of course. I have kind of dislike of all governments, and so I think perhaps it's better that I don't. Of course, if I was in a communist country, why then I would probably have it automatically and probably do what I wanted to do. Because if I wanted to write religious music, you can call it by any name, or you can always adjust those things. The Sufis, for instance, within Mohammedanism, have their own religion, and in the Elizabethan period, there were many secret religious groups that had nothing to do with the state religion or anything else, and many artists were connected with those groups, usually. So I think it really doesn't matter. One takes what one can get and earns one's living according to what I could do, either teaching, playing. I used to play piano a good deal. So I don't know. Subsidy, it depends on what people want as a payment for it if you get the subsidy.
I know that you were the pianist in your works last evening. And I have a very early record, a 78 recording, I think it was on a disc label, that you performed of. I can't recall too many other recordings of you performing your own works. Was there a period there where you didn't play the piano?
There was quite a long period when I didn't play. I used to play a great deal, and then I had trouble with arthritis, and I finally gave it up for a while, but because I want to give concerts with my wife, and I like her singing very much. I enjoy playing again. I'm trying to develop it. To a certain extent. It used to be my way of earning a living, and I used to teach too back in the 30s and early 40s. So it was, it's natural to come back to it, and I enjoy it.
I know that there's a very interesting symphony of yours that you recently wrote for Korea. Is that symphony number 35?
That's 35, yes, number 35, for two orchestras.
Mm-hmm.
One orchestra of Korean instruments, ancient Korean instruments, some of which I studied when I was in Korea before, and a regular symphony orchestra. See, my 16th symphony was also written for a few, about three Korean instruments, two percussion instruments and the kayagum, which is the Korean type of koto.
Mm.
And I conducted that in 63, I think it was, yes, the New Year's celebration, Lunar New Year, over the radio. And it's been recently played again in their festival last year, or maybe in the year before. Very recently, though, they sent me a beautiful program of it that they played it on. And so they commissioned a new work, combining two orchestras on the same stage. They're building a new music center or art center, pavilion or something, and they want to open it with this new symphony. So they'll be doing it June 9th, and I'm hoping to go with my wife and sort of see that everything is okay, the relationship between the two orchestras, and if anything.
So you'll be supervising, or will you be conducting also? Or?
I don't know as I'll be conducting. They have some very good conductors, but I'll sort of be supervising it a little bit. And I think that will be a very interesting experience.
Mm-hmm. Are you working on your 36th symphony?
Yes. Yes, I am. This will have a prominent flute solo part, which will be played by Ron Paul with the National Symphony early in January next year. So that's the main work I'm working on right now. And I've gotten to about the end of the first movement when we came here, so I had to leave it in Seattle until I get back.
I know when you came out to for the premiere of your 26th symphony with the San Jose Symphony,
yes.
That was only, what, 2 or 3 years ago now?
That's right, yes.
You really have composed 9 or 10 symphonies in the interim.
I have, yes.
It seems like you're turning into another Havergal O'Brien or something and turning out the symphonies.
It just happens so, I know. It's it seems that way. I think it's because of particular commissions I've had, and then I had two from the Armenians. That is a whole concert, and I did my 27th and 28th for them. Then that concert I was disappointed. It suddenly fell through and nothing happened. So I wondered what I was going to do with those two symphonies. But now we'll be doing it April 23rd this year.
Mm-hmm.
So since it's in the papers and has been publicized, I think they've spent some money. They'll go through with it.
Right.
So then after that, the Minnesota Symphony with their assistant conductor, he's also a very fine baritone horn player, and he went into symphonic work using that. So that was the 29th Symphony, and that got some very exciting performances with the Minnesota Symphony Orchestra. Then a request for a band arrangement of that symphony, so I made another version for band, which was done in Interlaken. So
that just this last summer?
Yes, that was. So that's the 29th Symphony. There were two others which I had gone out of. Let's see. I'm not sure. The 30th is a work which was dropped by a publisher. It was a cantata, and I made that into a symphony because I wasn't sure whether I could get permission to have the thing republished by another publisher in that form. So I remade it. It was in several movements. I combined it into three movements. That became the 30th Symphony. And the 31st was for strings. That was just done in Seattle. It says, that's the one that says EL or something like that.
Oh, yeah, on the program here, it says, it said, it was a misprint, and said Symphony Number L.
Yeah, that's number 31. And 32 and 33 are actually made for ballet groups.
Have they been performed with dancers?
Yes, they will be. They haven't yet been. But so they will be performed probably first with dancers. 33 was actually made from a score of only 7 instruments, but I felt I wrote it for this ballet group, and then I felt that I could do more with it, so I made it into an orchestral, and I added to it. So the 34th is strings and bass trombone. That's a special commission. And the 35th is for Korea. The 36th is for the National Symphony. So that's how it happens.
You'd be approaching Mozart before too long.
Well, if I can.
Then there's Haydn.
Haydn is no danger of approaching him.
Have you written other music specifically for dance?
Quite a lot, yes. Actually, the 13th Symphony is based on my first collaboration with Martha Graham, and it was that was done very successfully in other countries and in the Orient. By the time she did it in New York, they changed dances so much that I don't think it worked out quite so well. It didn't have quite the impact that it had in Europe. But that symphony is based on dance. And also, the 25th is another work for Martha Graham that I took parts of it and made into the Odysseus Symphony. she called it the myth or something, but didn't mention Odysseus, although that was the thing we both had in mind at the beginning when we were talking about it.
It seems as though you have a natural affinity for Martha Graham's work.
Yes.
You're very similar.
And, some, and
your,
many of
where
her
you're
dancers.
Coming from.
Yes, and many of her dancers. Yuriko, for instance, mm-hmm. I worked with her a great deal. And Jean Erdman, who used to be with Martha Graham, and then other dancers in New York, several, quite a few dancers actually, and Eric Hawkins, Stuart Rhodes, Stuart Hodes was one of her dancers. A lot of dancers use my music. I haven't actually collaborated with them. They've just taken things and used them. So that apparently there's a dancer who's doing that in Palo Alto last night, or did in the night before. A trio of mine and something else. So that quite a few pieces are used by dancers.
I know that you've been well represented by recordings, and I guess the Symphony No. 25 is one of the ones that's been recorded, I guess, on the Poseidon label.
That's right, yes.
What's your connection with Poseidon?
Well, this was something I did myself at a time in a former marriage. And so this company I've given over to her along with, as a kind of division of property, so-called, the way they do things and when I was divorced. So I don't know now what happens with that, but she wanted to keep it, so that's okay.
Will you be adding works to that repertoire?
I may if I get enough, if I'm able to earn enough money to pay for everything, mm-hmm. then I may. But since my income is divided, so that I have to work doubly hard now, but that's okay.
What recording plans do you have for the pieces that we heard last night?
Well, I would like to make a recording with Hinako of several things, mm-hmm. so that these may be included partly. Of course, the Pericles pieces we'll hope to do with orchestra.
Right.
And in perhaps context with the whole opera, or possibly parts of the opera we may do somewhere next year. We were just talking about it last night, because I have a new commission for kind of an oratorio which will last 25 minutes, and there'll be room for many other things in the same program. So we may, if we can get the parts of Pericles finally copied, they're working on it. If it gets copied on time, then perhaps we can do parts of Pericles with chorus and a little more variety, so that we can give kind of preview of the idea of the work. The overture, for instance, which I did for the San Diego Youth Symphony before I did the opera. We can include that, and perhaps an entr'acte or two, and choruses.
How long is the whole opera?
About 2 hours of music.
Mm-hmm. And so far, it's never been performed in
its entirety? Hasn't been performed, no. Only the overture has been performed several times, but that was the first version. I later changed the ending because the overture went right into the storm scene. But when I decided to finally write the whole libretto of building the Shakespeare play into an opera, I found that the storm scene shouldn't come first. We had to have another scene. So I end up the overture in sort of more of an ending style, and doesn't go right into the opera, and then we go into entirely another scene first, and the storms come later.
I know that your recordings on MGM have long been some collector's items. Is there any possibility of a reissue of some of those recordings?
I wanted to when I was doing the Poseidon thing. The Poseidon recordings I started because I had so many requests because of these missing pieces,
right.
But I never could get permission, or never could find the tape, who had the tapes. Huh. If I could find who had the tapes, that would be fine. For instance, the Magnificat had been recorded by Louisville, and then they weren't reissuing it, so I was able to get permission to use that tape. But other tapes, I haven't been able to get permission. I never could find out who owns those tapes, or nobody seems to know anything about it. There was a whole circle of people, and it always landed back landing with the first person again. Nobody, they'd say, call so-and-so and so-and-so and finally give it. So I had to give up. The only way it could be done is if one can take some old recordings and somehow fix them up so they'll be listenable.
Right.
That could be done, perhaps, under proper engineering. I don't know.
It's a shame.
I don't think they know what they recorded of mine. I don't think the present MGM company cares or knows anything about it.
No. They had quite a wonderful series of modern American music back then.
Yes.
I guess it was in Ed the Cole. Early to mid-50s.
That's right. Ed Cole was responsible for that. Yeah. And he did a wonderful job. He did all of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember some of my, well, that was my first introduction to the St. Barton Symphony, which has since been re-recorded on Poseidon.
Yes. Yes, that I couldn't get that original tape, so I did it myself. But that was an awfully good one at MGM St. Barton. It was very good.
I know that the Mysterious Mountain is probably somewhat of a bestseller of yours, the recording on RCA, which was made, I think, with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra under Reiner's direction.
Yes, that was a wonderful recording.
And I still know that for many people, that's their first introduction to your music.
Yes. Well, it's always good when you have a major company that do work and keep it going, because so many times a major company may do something, but then it's deleted before you know it. You can't get it anymore. I'm glad that the Columbia records are all together now in one, because
right.
I hope they'll keep that going for a while.
Well, previously, I guess they packaged a piece of yours along with many other things. I think
that's
most
true.
Of those performances, weren't they with Castellanos?
They were, yes.
And then recently, I guess it was this last year, they came out with that one album that put all of the pieces under one.
That's right, they have them all. Now somebody's asking for the Sunrise piece, Island Sunrise, and nobody can find the parts.
Oh.
And so I can't afford to have the parts copied, and I can't copy them myself, as I'm copying my own parts many times. Because
mm-hmm.
I'm busy with new pieces, so I don't know what I'll do. But
there surely must be students who just give their eye teeth to work on copying.
Really? I don't know those students.
Maybe we can scurry up some.
Yeah, that would help. That's a short piece anyway. It's tricky parts because the percussion is very... There are a lot of percussion parts. All should go on one score so they can see what each other are doing with a cue as to where they come in and where they go out, because there's a lot of free rhythm in it. So that one part of the orchestra is playing in meter and the other's continuing this sound or stopping it and so on. So it has to be somewhat experienced copyists. I do it myself, but I just don't have time now.
Now you have a birthday coming up on March the 8th. I'd like to wish you a happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And many more of them.
Right.
I don't celebrate them anymore, but thank you very much.
Finish here, I guess, by thanking you for your time and your busy schedule. I know you have to go back to Seattle, tomorrow? You know
I have to go away tomorrow. I'm not going to Seattle until Wednesday, but I don't come back here again.
I see.
So we'll be having a kind of tight schedule between the...
It's really a shame you couldn't have been spending more time here. We could have arranged these things
yes.
a little better, but I certainly do appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much. I'll try, I guess, to stay longer next time I come this way.
Right.
Most people find that in San Francisco.
I never have time enough here, yes.
Yeah, they need a few days at least.
That's true. I know last time I didn't have enough time either. The arias from the opera Pericles were written a little while ago. They, of course, should be accompanied by orchestra, and they'll sound much more beautiful that way. But I also have a hope sometime that this opera may be produced and that my wife can take the part of Marina. These arias I wrote for her, and actually the orchestration, too, is delicate the way it should be for a coloratura soprano, who doesn't have an immense fat voice to sing over a Wagnerian orchestra. It's accompanied very lightly, with very delicate colors, although I use full orchestra in this opera, but there are many choruses and many other solo passages for other voices, but wherever Marina sings, it's done very, almost with a kind of tempestuous, almost celestial, mysterious sound rather than anything that would, so any sound that she makes can be easily, very easily heard. The last one, The Presentiment, this is a poem about a thunderstorm which I found very exciting. When I was about 6 or 7 years old, I happened to see it in a book of Bryant's poems. He was a Victorian poet, but a nature poet. And of course, I was a great walker in those days. Well, that is, I would walk sometimes 25 miles in one day in the countryside, and I found that very inspiring. And also, I climbed every hill or mountain that I could to get near enough to climb. And I watched many terrifying but beautiful thunderstorms. I was scared of them, but I watched them. I loved the way they would come on and then gradually disappear. So that this poem attracted me very much. It must have been inspired by Goethe's Erl Koenig poem, of course. And of course, I love Schubert, so I wanted to see if one could do a different kind of Erl Koenig, possibly even with orchestra, but it turned out this way because I thought, I'll do it now for high voice, which is very difficult to do in a sense, because she has to imitate the child and the father and also be a narrator too. And I paint the lightning in slow motion, so to speak, near the end of the piece when the thunderbolt comes and strikes the tree and kills the child. So this is a kind of fantasy or a sonata, a dramatic sonata for piano and voice. I've written quite a few things for my wife and smaller things too. So we've done different programs around Seattle and other places. I have some cantatas and other larger works also, which I hope to do sometime around here.
Were the encores also written for your wife?
Let's see, yes. The last one was written just a few days ago about this cat that, I'm not supposed to have a cat in this apartment, but the cat sort of took us over, and then we finally found a home for it. But in the meantime, the thing that decided me was that somebody in the building decided to take the cat out to the pound, and then we hunted around different pounds because we felt very badly. There was no cat one day, and we knew that there was something wrong. So we found out about that, so we searched in different pounds, and we finally found him, and just managed to save him just the night before he would have been done out of life. So then later we advertised and we found a home for him. I'm trying not to be too friendly with any other cats right now because this is a terrible weakness.